Hey, everybody.
Let me tell you guys that I am so excited. I am so happy. I am really so thrilled to be right now sharing this amazing, glorious, super exciting moment
to the independent
of my
podcast. So, and today we have a special guest, Fraser Rice. How's it going, Fraser?
Terrific. Glad to be on.
Thank you very much for joining us on this call. And we hope to discuss many interesting things with you.
Terrific.
So yeah, Fraser, you have a long career in wealth management and investments. You've been on basically working as a senior wealth strategist. You've been a president in a wealth management company, advisor. And could you maybe tell us a little bit more about yourself and just make a little brief introduction, I guess, for the people who are listening?
Sure. So I feel like I've had three careers before I got to wealth management, or wealth management's my third career. I started out, I worked in politics out of college. I worked for the Department of Economic Development in New York. So I ran across basically every county in New York trying to help keep jobs in the state or otherwise attract them, which is tough because we have a lot of taxes and infrastructure issues and it's expensive to be in New York. And if you're manufacturing, you probably want to go somewhere else. I didn't want to be a civil servant my whole life, so I did what other lost souls do, and I went to law school. And I went down to Emory, so I was in Atlanta. I had a lot of really good experiences there. I worked for the SEC and the Federal Reserve, and I worked for an entertainment lawyer, which was pretty cool. But during that course, it takes 3 years to get through law school. In my third year, I got the feeling I didn't want to be a lawyer either. And so I kind of had that in the back of my mind. But I got through law school, passed the bar, got back to New York, which was something I wanted to do. And I practiced for a couple years. And then I like the idea of using my law degree. I had a lot of interest in banking and the markets, largely through my SEC and Federal Reserve experience. And I wanted to be in front of people. So I met a fellow by the name of Tony Guernsey, who started up Wilmington Trust's office in New York. And it was a great way to get involved in the wealth management industry. And from there, I built my career.
Right. And yeah, that's interesting because usually people with some kind of a background similar to yours go to be financial lawyers, and there's a whole space in the whole industry for that one as well.
Yeah. Well, what I discovered in my legal career, short as it was that I didn't like being the guy who said no or it depends. So as with many lawyers, sometimes, when you're trying to drive advice, you're providing strictly a legal framework for people. And there's something either in my DNA or in my experience in politics or somewhere else that said, I want to provide deeper things and also use the numerical side of my brain and help people get where they're going a little bit faster.
Right. That's great. That's great. So let's start with, since we're both, me and Bill, we're kind of a younger generation. We just finished with our master's studies in finance, and the podcast is about mostly helping young people learn more about finance, because usually finance, at least from our perspective, is portrayed in the public as, oh yeah, it's a numbers thing. So like you either get it or you don't get it. But at the same time, it really impacts your life, whatever you're doing on a larger scale. And you, from all the crises and in general, people tend to ignore that part of their life. But in the end, like if you mess up, it can have a very, very big impact on your future. So let me ask you, like, in terms of wealth management and not really wealth, since we're talking about young people in the beginning, what would be your advice to younger generations coming out of college currently with the current situation in the United States?
Well, so lots to unpack there, but the biggest lesson that I think is useful for people as they start to make important choices about their lives, whether course of study in college, type of career they want to get into, whom they work for, the most important thing to me is really have a good handle on the power of compounding. And it's a concept that it's theoretically should be taught pretty early in life, but a lot of the damage or problems that I see with people who are coming out and developing their financial lives is they have a lot of debt. And they've got the power of compounding working against them. The interest rates, the time value of money, et cetera, is not helping them. I try to encourage people to really get a handle on the fact that if you can have the power of compounding working for you, that it's so powerful. And then, you know, when you're coming out of college, one of the greatest assets that you have besides your brain and, you know, your ability to make money and so on is time and lack of commitments. And if you can start to build your life around using compounding so that you can increase your side of the balance sheet much more than maybe the liability side, you're going to set yourself up for better success later on. By the same token, I'm not saying don't borrow to get educated, but be smart about how you do it so that you're not only pursuing the things you want to learn about, but you're also pursuing practical skills so that you can, mm-hmm. you can have money coming in and you can whittle debt down and you can save money for other goals like buying a house and getting married and starting a family. Becomes much more tough if you've got a huge financial hole. And a lot of times that starts with not understanding how interest works both on the positive side and on the negative side.
And I wanted to ask you, you said power of compounding. Do you mean when you say power of compounding just in a pure financial sense, or is it something that can translate to other aspects of life?
Well, it is, so certainly in the financial sense, so that if you have a big debt burden, that limits your options as it relates to what you can pursue. In terms of talking about it in other parts of your life, I'm a big believer that as you build skills and build relationships over time, it starts out small, you do one thing at a time and so on. But as you get older and you build and maintain these relationships, the power of compounding really can translate to that. It's as you get more and more involved and you have more and more people, relationships, skills, et cetera, you become that much better at what you do. And you also have an ability to see around the corner a little bit better when things are sort of either financially difficult or other things pop up.
So it's a kind of an idea that doing little things at a time will compound and affect your life positively on the grand scheme.
Correct. I completely agree with that.
Okay. Fraser also got a question. Do you think that it's particularly difficult in the US to save because everything basically screams at you in a metaphorical sense to consume and to buy and to also spend over your actual money you're earning?
Well, it's difficult to control your appetites. There are lots of things out there to distract you, and there's a lot of ways to have fun and I live in New York City, and you could probably guess it's pretty expensive here. That gets back to not only the power of compounding, but something that I think is a good discipline to sort of establish early on is to really hone in on budgeting and make sure that you know what you're spending money on. And from a pure investment or saving standpoint, you know, one of the real bromides that's out there is you want to pay yourself first, which is sort of an anachronism for saying, make sure you save first before you start spending on things. And I believe in that. I think if you can continue to sort of put things away, then, you know, get back to the power of compounding component, it should be growing over time. And if you can get that working for you and stick to a discipline where you say, okay, I'm going to save something, anything, and keep that moving going forward, that's progress. If you stop doing it and you start spending down what you're bringing in, that's when the power of compounding is working against you. And if you're borrowing in order to fund that spending, that amplifies the damage.
Mm. Would you say that you should teach this the younger generation maybe as early as secondary school?
Oh yeah, I think even if you don't teach it in a pure numbers sense, if you teach it graphically or even as a set of anecdotes, I would start it as early as possible. I think the more you can ingrain these instincts, the faster it turns into actual practice. By the same token, you don't want people to not take risks and so on, especially early, because that's the time to do it. But to take informed risks and to understand that digging yourself a hole out of ignorance, that can lead to significant financial damage going forward.
Yeah, especially in a time where I think I would almost say it's harder for us to delay gratification because we're so used to instant gratification everywhere around us. We buy a coffee at Starbucks, we buy coffee at Dunkin' Donuts. We buy the new iPhone immediately. Like everything is at hand. Everything is there immediately and available.
No question about it. I think that sort of instant versus delayed gratification, you know, I think teaching delayed gratification early on is a good thing because it also hopefully fosters a good work ethic and it fosters patience and it fosters the need to have a broader vision for things. And that's a tough one, but you know, there are lots of different tools out there to try to do that. And ultimately that's having a good support system and a good educational system, hopefully good teachers to try to help people think about that.
Yeah.
And now on the grand scheme of things, that we're talking about this kind of incentivized spending society that we live in. To what extent do you think that kind of our modern economies depend on this concept of always kind of spending more because we are like consumer societies?
They are highly dependent on it. I think that, the stat, and it may be a little bit different from what I remember, but I believe U.S. Consumption drives 25% of the world economy. And so I live in New York and I'm American and I look at that and say, yeah, that's a crazy statistic, but at the same time, it makes some sense. And then as you look around to friends, family, and other statistics, and you see what drives economies and hot stocks out there, and you say, well, there's Google and Facebook, and it's all advertising driven. And if people don't pay for advertising through the sale of their products, then everything kind of falls apart. It's a tough situation. I think there is a place though for people to ingrain saving into their own personal situations. And I don't think you have to feel guilty about not contributing to the U.S. economy or to the stock market or something like that through your own spending. I think everyone's different. And ultimately, economies figure that out. And if people change their habits such that they're protecting their own individual lifestyle, you know, there'll be industries that pop up around that and possibilities for investment. But to get back to your first point, I think you're right. I think that, it's a consumer economy. I think certainly back since the 80s in the U.S., greed is good and conspicuous consumption and social cues and things like that, those are out there and have never really gone away. My counterargument to that would be that a lot of sort of ESG, sort of environmental, social, and governance aspects to investing are becoming sort of popular now. It's a balance, but ultimately you can take care of what you can take care of, and that's your individual situation, and hopefully some good habits have been formed ahead of time.
You mentioned ESGs. I did some research for a class that I was tutoring for here at Halt University, and with regards to ESG itself, and I want to ask you, maybe I know you're from New York, so maybe you have a kind of a more closer up look. Is that from my research, what I figured out is that there are a lot, especially on Wall Street, there are a lot of these ESG now funds that are coming up, which charge higher fees, and they're really popular, especially with the millennials and the younger generation. But at some certain level, they're also some of them are not very honest. Do you have any opinion about this? Sorry for jumping topic to topic, but I just wanted to probe.
No, that's okay. I do have opinions on it. I think that from an ESG perspective, I think it has blossomed from sort of an idea to a trend. I think there are some good components where people who want to do more with their investment dollar than beyond just make a return, or if they have legitimate concerns over how their dollars are invested, there are a lot of different products that have sprung up to address that. By the same token, I'm a big believer that it is much more productive to invest for an outcome than to invest away from one. And by that, I mean that, you know, there are lots of ESG funds out there and there are lots of numerical screens and data and so on that they get you to one place or another. I would take the position that if you give me enough time, I can find something that's extremely wrong with every company that you can invest in. Whether it's they have bad vendors or they produce bad things, or they use vendors who have issues, or they have child labor problems, or they don't have enough women on the board, or they don't represent minorities enough in executive situations. If I look hard enough, I think I can find black dots on pretty much any investment. So that ends up being a very sort of expensive in terms of time exercise as to how you screen these things and what makes an appropriate investment. I'd much rather be on the side of helping people invest in outcomes that they want. That is to say, you know what, I want to invest in two or three companies that have broader diversification on the board of directors. So, you find things that do that. And that's sort of a better way to do it than to try to screen away bad actors. Good actors will, if by example they attract better capital, that's going to promote better activity amongst the worst players. By the same token, sort of environmental components, if companies aren't taking care of the environment when producing products that people need, and I'm sort of thinking plastics providers, it's not a zero, or it's not, you can't be perfect, but you can see people trying. And I think that's a good thing to reward as well with an investment dollar. To get back to your point, I think that, a lot of, just because it says ESG and socially aware or socially responsible, I think it merits a deeper look by someone before they drop money into those types of programs, just to see what the actual methodology is. Plenty of good methodologies out there, and there are other ones that I sort of look at it and say, not so much. And it begs a bigger question. If you're investing in the ESG principles or socially responsible principles, do you have to give up a rate of return in order to get that other, let's call it psychic income, that your investment dollar is doing more? To me, the research on that is mixed, and I think it's going to take a while to see whether any of those lessons are borne out. I would imagine on the governance side of things, if your company's governed well and you have good representation, that should create a better culture for profit and long-term profit. That to me is something that I would focus on a lot. And then on sort of the environmental and social components, I think that flows from good corporate governance. So if I really had to put pen to paper and commit to something, I'd say, those are the parts I'd really focus on as I looked at different funds and vehicles that invest in that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And just to play the devil's advocate now, I mean, yeah, I have the same perspective as you do. There are a lot of funds out there, and you kind of have to put your own research and see who's actually pretending to be an ESG, but then investing in tobacco companies, or who's actually doing what they're supposed to do. But to play the devil's advocate, the time that students that come out, I mean, young people that come out of college burdened with debt and also at the same time looking to invest some, you might say that they do not have enough time to go into these things, especially if they don't understand finance per se. What would be the advice in that sense? It's if you're in that position where you're going back and forth from your debt obligations to, you should probably be even investing if you have big debt obligations, right?
Well, not completely. I'd say it makes sense to at least have some savings components, whether retirement accounts or 401ks. If you end up working for somebody who has a 401k match, I would strenuously argue that you should be taking advantage of that. And I think you should be saving as much as you possibly can and whittling the debt down as best you can. I wouldn't do one at the exclusion of the other, because I think you've got to get both sides of the balance sheet in line. And then on the savings side of things, you get back to the power of compounding. You want that working for you. The issue is that at some point when you retire, you're not going to be able to earn income anymore. And at that point, you're not going to be able to grow the assets that you're going to need to be able to live off of. So if you completely exclude that from your financial planning at a young age, I think you could set yourself up for sort of a difficult middle agehood as you try to catch up and have enough assets to live off of. So I wouldn't do one at the exclusion of the other. To get back to the ESG component, and actually to bridge that with the with sort of the discussion of saving in general, I think the idea of having a diversification of assets, stocks and bonds, that type of thing, which is something people should also learn certainly in college, If ESG is part of that, I think that's a valid thing. And if that's part of a diversified portfolio, I think that's a good move. And if it ticks off a box for someone personally, I'm certainly not going to argue against that. My one comment is that if you're going to go into an ESG mutual fund or ETF or something like that, I would take 5 minutes and read through the one page literature and probably the prospectus if you have it, and just say, okay, what is their methodology for ESG? And then I would actually look and see what the top 10 holdings are, so that when push comes to shove and you look at how they're invested, you're not surprised by certain companies that are in there, no matter what the methodology is. And that shouldn't take too long. And that's also where, if you develop your networks and you have friends who are in the industry and can help you do that, that's one way to learn more about these things in a more comfortable setting. And finally, there's so much information on these different funds on the internet and through different research components. You don't have to go much further than typing into Google the different funds and to say, XYZ funds holdings, they should be able to pop up pretty quickly.
Yeah, we live in a day where the information is so readily available to us that we should definitely use that advantage. I also want to ask you, you mentioned your book and your comic that you're coming out with,
right,
for the podcast. And can you tell us a little bit more about this, where people can find it? And
sure. My book was Wealth Actually, and Intelligent Decision Making for the 1%. I wrote that it was written during 2017 and was published in 2018. So it's been out for about a year. I had really good sort of turnout for that, which was nice. And I go and I try to tell people in the book my experiences in advising wealthier folks and the issues that they have, mostly along the lines of how do you define success for yourself and how do you avoid a lot of the rookie mistakes that a lot of people make that can destroy wealth. And a lot of that centers around communication, avoiding bad habits, understanding your spending, a lot of the things that we've been talking about that people with extra commas in their bank accounts have those issues as well. But also good team building and how to build the right folks around you so that you're advised well as you move forward. That's accountants and lawyers, and for people who are buying and selling businesses or retiring from jobs and so on, having different experts around that so that you set yourself up for success going forward. So that book's been out for about a year. You can find that on Amazon. It's Wealth Actually, and I'm Fraser Rice. If you throw that into Google, it'll pop up very quickly. I have had a podcast, Fraser Rice's podcast, and that's been shifted over to Wealth Actually as well. I've been doing that for 2 years, and I interview a lot of entrepreneurs and experts and tastemakers and just people I find interesting and have a story to tell that I think people can learn from, not only on the wealth side, but just on a sort of a general interest side. And then on the further hobby component, co-writer and I signed up with Marcosia Publishing in the UK, and we have a graphic novel coming out called Stay Alive, and that should be coming out before the end of 2019. So we're excited about that.
That's great. And I want to ask you first to go back to your book. What would you say from your experience, what would be the difference between advices to people who are purely, young people who are purely selling their time for money versus asset owners or rich people or the 1%? What's the difference in the approach?
Great question. So I draw the distinction between there's two major distinctions that I would tell young people to focus on, or at least learn about. And the first one is current wealth versus legacy wealth. Current wealth is making sure that your financial needs and maybe the financial needs of your family are taken care of while you're alive. Legacy wealth is the wealth that you want to pass down to the next generation. And that second type of wealth, that legacy wealth, you have a much longer time horizon, and it sort of provides the opportunity for different types of investing, less turnover type of investing, more aggressive types of investing, something that gets away from the cash flow components of life, that sort of current investing and making sure that your bills are paid and that your retirement's paid for and your kids' educations are paid for. So that's one area that I would get. I would tell people, especially young people, that it's good to understand the difference between those two. The second part that I think is interesting and useful is the idea of income versus assets. And so for people who are on the wealthier side of things, have high income, a very difficult transition for them to make is when they retire and they had been used to making sort of big paychecks, but then they have to live off of the assets that they have saved for. And by the same token, there's some people who have lots of assets, but not much in the way of income. And so they have a different set of problems. I try to counsel people to understand the difference between the two so that they can set themselves up to have a balance of both assets and income so that they can fund their current lifestyle while having the assets available to be able to generate cash flow to not only fund their lifestyle, but the lifestyle of their family, and then possibly have something to pass down in that legacy wealth scenario to the next generation or to their philanthropies. So those two dichotomies, in a sense, are good things for young people to understand as they put their careers together and as that they start saving for retirement and understanding what that means. Understanding where the cash flows are going to come from, but then understanding what the asset base is going to look like when they aren't working any longer.
That sounds great. That was a great description, I guess. So you mentioned before that you were also working for SEC. You were at the same time had like a whole political side, and we want to ask you from like a bigger picture. Let's say currently, what's your opinion on the U.S. economy and going forward?
Well, so there's a lot of data points going forward and backward on that one. It seems like inflation continues to be low. Interest rates are jury-rigged to be low. Consumption still seems to be okay. And so the market is a reflection of that is the stock market, which seems to be doing all right. However, you know, depending on whom you speak to, many people think that that's richly valued. And then by the same token, interest rates being low, that creates difficulties for people in the fixed income markets. It's difficult to invest in bonds and hope to earn a rate of return that's going to keep up with inflation. You look at those, and as it relates to how do you invest, I hearken back to a lot of different principles, which is to understand what your spending needs are, what your income needs are. Once we have that information in place and we understand what your goals and objectives are over the next periods of time, the answer to those questions helps to inform asset allocations and how you split between stocks and bonds and maybe alternative assets. If the expected return of stocks, and I think the general consensus is that it's around 7% and that bonds is, let's say, 3%, you know, it's a good idea to understand that your assets are going to be able to, as you mix your asset base on that front, those are the returns you should be able to expect. And if you can build a portfolio that can withstand volatility, and let's say Trump tweets something crazy or he gets impeached or you know, there's a geopolitical issue that happens and the market goes down 20%, the real interesting part is to try to help clients understand how do we withstand these kinds of downdrafts so that you don't have to sell at the bottom in order to fund your lifestyle and your goals. And if we can build portfolios around that concept, that creates less friction or agita for the client when crazy things happen that we can't predict. Ultimately, you know, as I try to think about geopolitical risk and, you know, when things can snap down and snap back up, you know, I look back at what we think about from a sort of macroeconomic component and a sort of a projection of where stocks and bonds have been before and what are projected to look at going forward. If we can beat inflation and we can do it on an after-tax and after-fee basis, that's a good start. And then, you know, on the sort of behavioral side of things, if I can coach people to, you know, keep the spending in line, and, you know, if your burn rate after all of that is less than what you're making and what you're saving, that's a good outcome.
And how important is the diversification when you mentioned this wealth management and avoiding volatility? How do you put the special note on diversification when you advise your clients, or what do you consider to be a key in avoiding volatility?
Sure. The short answer is yes. I think to not be diversified is it's a mistake. I think people take plenty of risks, sort of financially. Many times, if they're building their own business, that's not very diversified. You're doing your thing. If you're working for somebody, you have made a big bet on one particular company, and you're betting your time and the resources and income that's coming back from that. So to make further huge bets elsewhere in a portfolio, that's certainly not standard operating procedure. And frankly, it's I think from a volatility standpoint, I think it can be to not have diversification, I think, can be a real problem. Now, especially as you're nearing retirement, I think being diversified is a good idea, because you're as good as the different asset classes that you're in, and they can go up and down for a lot of different reasons. If you take that one level of abstraction further and talk about the companies or specific bonds that are underpinning all that, lots of things can happen that we don't know about. We don't have to go back that far. I mean, it's 2008 when Lehman Brothers and AIG, and even nearer term, GE and Teva, you know, pretty good companies that have just gotten shillelied from a market value standpoint. And if you were overinvested in that, and they've come down so sharply, and you believed in them for one reason or another, and that can create a real move backwards in terms of lifestyle if you were over concentrated in those particular positions. So I counsel people to be diversified. I think to be thoughtful about the income and about the growth prospects that their portfolios can generate, so that they mix, they have that balance between building assets and generating income that allows them to have the lifestyles that they want.
I got a question. When you're counseling clients, do you also explain them? So do you like teach them while you're counseling them, not only with your book, but also while you have contact with them? Or is it more that they just formulate their goals, you build a portfolio, and then they just realize this portfolio, so to say?
Another good question. Every client that sort of happens comes in with a different level of education and a different point in their lifestyle. Some people that I've dealt with are far more sophisticated than I am in many ways, and they're using me and firm and et cetera for a specific need. And many times they want a discipline around their investment process, or they want some advice around the estate planning or the structuring around wealth. So sometimes they come to me in a narrow sense, and they want something specific. Other people don't, you know, I'm not saying they don't know anything, but they aren't sophisticated, or they don't know a lot, or this is a different mode of life than they are used to. They just sort of save things and put that on autopilot, and now they have to start using the apparatus that they built for themselves. So the education process, I and team and et cetera, try to educate while we're advising, and making sure that we're both on the same page in terms of understanding what things can do. And by and large, the education process isn't one way either. We need to collect data, and we need to understand what concerns the client and what makes them tick, because we could put together what may be technically accurate or sound advice, but if the client doesn't see how this is going to impact them positively, well, they're not going to take it. And so I think it's that gets back to really the communication component, which is, it's important for me and others to communicate the state of the world and the state of the markets and what they can do for you and what one's financial condition is from our particular opinion, But we need to hear too what the hopes, dreams, goals, objectives, worries, et cetera, are, because if we don't tailor our advice to those aspects, the advice isn't going to get used, or we're not going to get hired, or they're going to go with somebody else who better understands what they're doing.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And this is a kind of advice in disguise for me and Bill, or any people who are actually finance educated when they approach, because usually people ask you for some advices, but to communicate them well, I guess it's as important as knowing what's happening in the market, because in the end, if the person on the other end doesn't understand the reasoning, there's no point, I guess.
I would say too, I mean, sort of a strange little secret in the financial advisory business is that everything kind of works better if you take a longer term view of things and you're not stuck watching CNBC or Bloomberg every day. I think if you're following every blip from a pure sort of financial planning and long term perspective, you can just get inundated with information and distracted. And a part of our education process is to say, you know, help the client define what their goals are, short, medium, and long term. Try to make sure they're funded, put together asset allocations in place that get them where they're going, and check in, you know, on a routine basis, but not on a day-to-day basis, because I think, first of all, it drives you crazy. Second of all, it drives the client crazy. Third of all, I think that there's so many moves in the market, any one of a bunch of markets, that there never is necessarily a great answer for why. And you're better off, I think, having a longer term plan in place and then just modifying it around the edges as personal events warrant, as opposed to trying to sort of outpace or outdo the active management world, or trying to sort of really do better than the index, or try to pick the next company, or even try to pick the next great manager, which I think is a tough game too. There's a lot of things. In many ways, I try to encourage people to spend their calories on more productive pursuits, i.e. enjoy life. Or if you're building a business, focus on that, because if you're generating a lot of money, that can be, that's your edge. If you can focus on the things where you have an edge or a real deep interest, those are ultimately going to be profitable. If you can sort of delegate out the financial component, an area where you may not have as much interest or proclivity or even time or resources to devote to it, don't focus on that as much. And I'm not saying ignore it by any stretch. I'm not saying don't keep an eye on it, but don't obsess over it, because I don't think you're adding much value to your financial condition that way. And then by the extension of that is, you know, be informed, understand what your tax situation is, and have a core of people around you, whether sort of formally paid and engaged by you or otherwise, so that you have a sense of what's out there beyond just your silo and the TV.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what, like, one of the legendary investors, like Nassim Taleb, says, like, if the information is very important, it will find the way to me. Basically, if there's some big news, he'll find out anyways. He doesn't have to double check, triple check every day, read the Wall Street Journal, I guess. So you have to kind of guard yourself from the noise, because we have so many informations. And then, I guess, if you go on Bloomberg or Wall Street Journal, they always have some kind of a bad explanation why something happens, and there's always different whys to certain events.
I mean, I think for most people, they're just never going to be ahead of the market like that. And I'm not saying don't read the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg. It's okay to read those things, but just understand that you, if you're not deeply in the business, you're not going to have any sort of informational advantage. So to that extent, you try to you know, have people or experts around you to maintain a longer term discipline, so that you're using the markets to get where you're going, as opposed to the markets using you. If that makes
exactly.
sense.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Fraser, thank you very much. It has been very a very insightful interview. I guess people who are listening to this will learn a little bit more and actually have some key takeaways from this interview in terms of their own wealth management, and where do they get to invest, and maybe how they approach their assets or money or cash, whatever they have. Maybe to conclude, do you have any questions for me and Bill, are there any topics you would have liked to explore?
Well, I guess from my perspective, I think I'm interested in what you guys are seeing in the investment world. What's interesting to you? I have situations where CBD oil or Beyond Burger or different fintech type things, 50 different investment ideas sort of crossed my path for one reason or another. And my question would be, what's exciting to you guys? What are you seeing that's turning you on and that you think are great opportunities?
Well, me personally, and Bill can speak after, personally, I think that we have to be careful at this time because especially when you look at the current IPOs and there are many companies that I believe are coming out and they brought their value up in terms of kind of following the Jeff Bezos recipe of, yeah, we can incur losses, but at the same time, we're going to be a great company in the future. So invest in us now and we're going to be the new Amazon. And if you look at many new IPOs coming up, I believe that all of them are kind of, not all of them, but like some majority of them, like Uber, Lyft, WeWork, Spotify, they're running big losses, and I think at that aspect we should be kind of careful when we look at these companies. Is this actually going to be a business that's going to be profitable in the future? Is this going to be the new Amazon, or if the economic downturns come, this company is going to just break completely? From my perspective, I mean, we're both based in Boston, and it seems to me that everything that's popular in Boston in terms of investment, in terms of startups, it's some kind of an AI, it's some kind of a machine learning, it's some kind, if either in healthcare, sports, wherever you have these sports trackers, Whoop, you have in healthcare, they want to automatize basically the whole healthcare industry. Radiology is completely becoming machine based, where all your scanners and stuff will be done by machine and analyzed by machines. You don't need people anymore. So like, at least from my feeling, from the startup market, this is where a lot of money is going in. And I think these folks are getting a lot of investments currently. And in terms of what's attractive on the market there, I like the approach of looking outside of what is kind of popular. I know Beyond Meat is very popular currently, but I like the approach of looking where nobody else is looking, and especially if you have people who are in the business itself. And personally, I like one stock or one company. I don't want to suggest anything because I don't support stock picking, but that brought interest to me is this triathlon Ironman competitions that actually got public in July, and they're very cheap. And for me, I know a couple of people who are in the industry and actually competing there, and it seems to be growing, and personally that's interesting, but I wouldn't recommend nothing to anybody because I don't believe in stock picking as being a successful investment strategy. So,
right. It sounds like it's a trend that I've noticed is very popular. The Iron Man and the Tough Mudders and things like that, they're popular and growing.
Yeah, and the stock is $4. So like, even if you go for it, you buy 100 shares, you're not gonna risk your lifetime savings in actually investing in it. There's a huge upside, but the downside is not so big. So I'm all about that. And yeah, Bill, what about you?
So yeah, for me, I would say so. I'm also interested in how this whole bubble-like area almost turns out for the IPO landscape with WeWork, with Uber, with Lyft, because I don't really know what to think about Lyft and Uber, because they're incurring huge losses, but at the same time, they're actually offering something everybody needs. And after the last changes to the law in California, if they suddenly have to consider all their Uber drivers a real, not a contractor, but an actual employee, then they might suddenly be a huge company, actually, and might be forced to pay huge health benefits and all that stuff. What is around us and what they have to pay in the background when they have actual employees. on the other side, I'm also interested in AI. I'm also working in an AI startup. So that's why I'm thinking, like, how, to what extent will this go? How far can we automate that? I think doctors will never be obsolete. Doctors will only get a good amount of help by AI at the end of the day. So that's why I think this AI will really overtake a good portion of healthcare, and also of the finance industry. But at the same time, I'm thinking, where will this whole area of automated driving or of assisted driving lead us? Because Tesla, for example, is more serving the area of assisted driving. So the driver is still there, and the car is still planned to have a driver and it can intervene. But at the same time, how will it turn out when Daimler and BMW and General Motors have finished their work on these autonomous truck fleets that are basically not even supposed to have a driver anymore? So, because on that day, we theoretically could fire every single truck driver who ever existed. So I'm thinking, like, how will this turn out? I'm part of the lawmaker and part of the society to slow this down, to not have a huge disaster, basically, with all this automation going on.
Yeah, no, I a lot of good points there. And on the Uber Lyft front, and I use Uber and Lyft periodically. I use another service called Via, which is in New York. It's particularly, the algorithm is a little bit better. Mm-hmm. I think these guys are all, in a sense, trying to finance their way to the point where they don't need the drivers anymore. And so the driverless components you talked about, whether GM, Daimler, Waymo, and some of the other ones, I think we're closer to that than we think. And the Uber driver, and maybe the California law that, they sort of graduate from being independent contractors to employees, that may matter less than we think. There's also AOC has put out something where she wants to have a bailout for the medallion owners in the taxi world in New York City, which is, I saw that and my eyes went wide, because I think that's, it doesn't make a ton of sense to me, but.
Sorry for interrupting. What do you mean by medallion owners?
So in New York City, the taxis, the yellow taxis, you have to get a medallion from the city in order to operate. Uber, Lyft, et cetera, there's a different classification, which is much less rigorous to be able to drive those around. And New York is trying to deal with a huge influx of Uber, Lyft, via other services, drivers in the city. We've already sort of constricted the roads for bike lanes and things like that, and now we've got a whole bunch more cars and a whole different way of driving and a lot of different construction, so our traffic is crazy. And what it did is it you pay for a medallion, and they can run, they used to be up to $1 million for a medallion to be able to operate a taxi, and now it's down in the, I think it, I'm not positive about this, but I think it's in sort of the $200,000 or $300,000 range. Mm-hmm. And they, it created a huge problem for people who, have a huge net worth component in what they think was an asset, and it came straight down because this innovation came to play. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of talk about trying to help keep the taxis supported. And against that backdrop, taxes are going up. It's now $6 or $7 to even get into a taxi anymore in New York. And to get anywhere is no cheaper than $10. And to go not very far is $20. And it's changed a lot of people's behavior. And you sort of dovetail that against subways that need a lot of work and are already bursting at the seams. It's a tough time. A lot is happening that's good in New York, but there's a lot that's a little bit scary in terms of infrastructure. And when we're not that positive about bringing firms like Amazon in, and that's a little bit scary.
Yeah, I wanted to make two comments. One with regards to Uber, I'll actually listen to a nice. There was, I think, Wall Street Journal article about Uber, and it offered a nice perspective where to one of the people who was working as a lawyer for Uber and managed their investments a little bit, he was saying that Uber was never made to be a primary job, which is basically happening now due to the income inequality. Some people are working full-time for Uber, but he's saying that when founders of Uber made Uber, they were never thinking that this is going to be a full-time job for somebody. So this is why maybe currently they're dealing with something that they weren't predicting at the time. And also, I would like to say, in terms of what you said, what interests me, I forgot to say, it, in a certain way, cryptocurrencies as well. I know it's a super volatile market, but at the same time, it's something to keep in mind on because it's completely not correlated with the outside world, with the markets itself themselves.
So, yeah. So on the cryptocurrency front, I'm my thoughts on that continue to evolve. I still like the idea of a currency having the backing of a country, as weak as that may be, depending on the country. But I'm still trying to get my arms around the store of value idea behind these different currencies. I'm a little worried about at the Bitcoin level, the fact that you can fork them so often. And one of the notions was that there's a finite amount of Bitcoin out there. And so mm-hmm. that's part of the reason why value continues to store. By the same token, if you go into Litecoin and other types of things based off of that same chassis, that scares me a little bit. And I get a little bit worried about cybersecurity issues and custody, really the custody issues. You know, if your Bitcoin is on your hard drive and your hard drive tanks or someone absconds with that, how do you deal with it? Those parts concern me. Ethereum and a lot of currencies based on that are starting to become interesting too. So I don't have an opinion on that yet. I'm still in the learning mode. I do think that blockchain, and it kind of got very popular, and now people are sort of settling back in and saying, geez, this is a lot of work. I think there are a lot of things that can be disrupted with a lot of blockchain technology out there. As an example, I think there's room for improvement in the title insurance industry with blockchain. I think it's expensive to sort of move one property from somebody's name to another. And if there are ways to reduce friction with a centralized and maybe sort of decentralized component in terms of transferring property from one person to another, I think there's room for that. But also in the financial transfer of payments world, if I remember correctly, there's 5 to 6 to 7 points of contact between moving dollars or some currency from one country to another. Blockchain should be a tool that could reduce those points of friction and bring costs down for consumers. I see that as being an area where that kind of technology can and should move the needle.
Yeah, and especially when it comes to transferring money from banks to banks, this is where currencies like Monero really come into play. They're very focused on this, and I think that volatility is partially what's responsible for the volatility is that we're still not sure what's the underlying value. We don't know how we're going to use this asset, but in my personal opinion, the longer it exists, the more we are kind of aware, okay, this is going to have some kind of a value to us in the future. I personally believe that there are some things that can be dealt, like I agree completely with you, with applying blockchain. And in terms of Bitcoin, I really do believe that the underlying, because we usually talk about that there is not really an underlying value to Bitcoin, to these digital assets as well. But if you look in terms of the mining industry and the whole mining industry, the size of it currently is insane. In the beginning of September, one of these miner producers called Bitmain released a new machine, and only in a couple of days they made $600 million from the sales of these machines.
Oh, wow.
And
it has all sorts of ramifications too, because the mining industry, I don't remember what the stat was, but it sucks out a lot of power to be able to, you know, sort of run the computational needs you need to do in order to participate in the mining component. And I think Bitcoin is a real thing and it's here to stay. And it's something that we have to deal with and use and incorporate and understand. but it's evolving so quickly, it's tough for me to have a firm opinion on it right now. But it's not something to ignore. I did a podcast with a guy named Tyrone Ross, who's a forceful advocate of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And we weren't fighting really, but I had more of a wait and see approach, and he was a little bit more sort of forward on it. And to me, when you start seeing it where people are willing to pay Bitcoin or Ethereum or Ripple or something like that for real estate, that's when you know it's really arrived. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my personal shorthand for cryptocurrency validity and mass adoption.
That completely makes sense. Well, thank you very much. I think there's been a very, very productive 1 hour. A lot of topics were considered, from cryptocurrencies to Uber to personal wealth. And definitely, I hope that people can take away from this podcast. And yeah, can you maybe tell the listeners where they can find you again? Once again, website, the book, wherever.
Sure. You would like to. First of all, thanks, Vlad. Thanks, Bill. Really appreciate being on. I'm Fraser Rice. You can find me at wealthactually.com. And Wealth Actually is on Amazon. And if you Google Fraser Rice, I come up pretty quickly. So it was a pleasure to be on. And thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.